on News Talk as part of our winter season of Documentary on News Talk, producer Judy Megnikaneja looks at the creation of a new Gaeltacht in Meath in the 1930s in The Making of a Gaeltacht.
It's March 1934, and a convoy of bicycles is setting out from Connemara to Dublin. This will become known as Antaras Anir, or the Journey East, and it will result in an unprecedented move by the government. The creation of a new Gaeltacht in County Meath.
Irish Press, 2nd of April, 1934. Interview with Mr. De Valera. A deputation representing the 36 Gaelgori, who cycled from Connemara to Dublin, was received by Mr. De Valera at government buildings on Saturday and put forward suggestions for the improvement of Gaeltacht conditions. The whole party marched with their cycles from the Gaelic League offices, Parnell Square, to Merrion Street, where they waited while the members of
It was a headlining publicity stunt. As Ireland suffered under the weight of worldwide depression, with chronic unemployment and poverty, the people of the Gaeltacht regions were mobilising and demanding assistance from the government. This is how the story of the Meath Gaeltacht begins, the largest ever official resettlement of people within the state.
Well, you know, the whole idea of land distribution began as far back as the late 19th century with the Land Commission. They were concerned about the congestion in the west of Ireland.
This is historical geographer Suzanne Pegley, whose work on the Gaeltacht migration builds on the research in Terence Dooley's book, Land for the People.
As time moved on then, and we got closer to independence, it became much more of a hot issue. But by the time of independence, with Cumna Gael in power, they really began to address the whole issue of land redistribution. And the whole way of doing it was, beginning back with the Land Commission, was to buy up larger farms, move the farmers who had owned this land into other parts of the west of Ireland, and then redistribute the land that they had acquired in the west. And this worked fine, and it was a lot of consolidation of smaller plots of land. In other words, you may have had 5 acres, but the 5 acres were scattered over maybe a 10-acre range. So by buying up and moving around and shifting, it was like that little game with plastic things. You make all the little keys fit together in an order. So this is what they were doing. By 1903, however, the Land Acts changed and they were allowed to move people out of the west of Ireland and into other parts of Ireland. So you had quite a big move then. So they were buying up large plots of land, maybe 160 acres, and moving these farmers out into other parts of Ireland, Meath, Kildare. And so you saw a change in the type of movement.
The west of Ireland, in all its rugged beauty, was a difficult place to survive at the turn of the last century. There were far too many people on the land, many trying to make a living from the sea.
My father was out, they were out in a boat and the boat overloaded anyway. And Mike wasn't as good a swimmer as my father. He was a lot younger anyway than my father. And my father had to go down 3 times to save him. So Mike would always attribute the decision to come to County Meath as the day they went home, and said that my father said to his mother, you know, this is not right. You know, I think there is a better life for us.
The big changes then began to happen when people said, okay, things are very bad in the West. Our families, we can't send them away. We can't go to America or to Britain. We really demand much more land. And that's when the movements and the purchase by the government began in earnest.
Irish Press, 16th of January, 1935. farms and homes now ready. 900 broad acres of the finest land in Ireland have been laid out at Rathcarn, County Meath, to provide homesteads and farms for a number of Irish-speaking families drawn from the poorest parts of the Gaeltacht. Houses have already been erected, and the first arrivals, comprising 12 families of about 60 persons, will take up residence in March next. In the succeeding months, as fast as houses can be completed and farms allotted, further families will come from the Gaeltacht until upwards of 130.
With the settlement nearly ready for the new arrivals, all that remained was to decide who would make the move from the Gaeltacht to Meath.
The selection of migrants is based on an application form. And the application form was filled out by individuals who had some land in the West. It could have varied in size, who usually had a family. They were interested in bringing families up.
My father would have been the eldest at the time, along with his own mother. And in 1935, they made the decision to come to Rathcarn, which was very difficult considering that her own husband had died and she was in her 50s.
This is Cathal Seoige. His parents were among the first Gaeltacht migrants to Meath.
You know, to leave Letchamullan, which is as far back as she can go in Connemara, and they left Uncrook, which is part of Letchamullan, and they came to Rathcarn. Now, at that stage, my father had brothers and sisters that were going to national school. So he really, I suppose, along with his own mother, were the ones responsible for rearing that family.
The resettlement of Gaeltacht people would make up a very small part of a much larger project of land redistribution. And many people were keen to benefit. The question of who would benefit and why is an interesting one.
Once the applications came in, the Irish Land Commissioner in the West of Ireland, who would know the people, who would know the quality of land that they were being offered, would then conduct an interview. But the Land Commission records are closed to a casual research by historians. So there's no way of knowing the detail of the interviews or the questions or whatever was happening. But we do know quite certainly that it wasn't just the individual, the man himself. It wasn't always men, but usually men. They had to have a family. They had to have a wife, but they couldn't just have any old wife. They had to have a woman who was also a good person, who was going to look after the chickens, who was going to look after the vegetables, who was going to be able to be a good homemaker. And so she was interviewed, perhaps not directly, but certainly when they visited the home would be inspected. If it was tidy and there was bread on the table and the chickens were there and the whole ethos of the house was examined. Plus, they needed a couple of children, you know, young men perhaps, or small boys was a good idea. They liked the idea of a gang of children. And of course, families were quite big in those days. Now, there were occasions then the head of the household was a woman, but she had sons, grown sons. So she was chosen as well. And that happened in Rathcarn. There would have been a family of maybe three or four, with the mother who was the head and the sons then who took charge of the farm.
Irish Press, 21st of January, 1935. About 40 men from the Connemara Gaeltacht, mostly stalwart young men of the farming community, travelled by bus from County Galway on Saturday to County Meath, where they inspected the new farm colony near Athboy, which is to be settled by residents from the Gaeltacht. Most of the visitors were members of the party who cycled last Easter from Connemara to Dublin to draw attention to the needs of the people of the Gaeltacht. They are all members of Muintir na Gaeltachta, the organisation which was formed after the trip to Dublin for the purpose of furthering the welfare of the Gaeltacht residents. A number were attired in the homespun tweeds of Connemara. The party, which was composed of Irish speakers from
now
all parts
we
of Connemara,
suspect that if you were a Fianna Fáil member, you stood a much, much, much better chance of becoming a migrant. And this was the whole questioning by other politicians in the Dáil, how the connectivity with Fianna Fáil assured you a place, and this was unacceptable as far as they were concerned.
In the beginning, I would imagine, and I heard stories as well, and I often remember my grandmother, that a car used to come in on the street to make sure that she did vote. Now, she never told me which way she voted, but I is remembering who was driving the cars, and even though I was a young fella, and remembering the characters, that it was surely had to be Fianna Fáil, you know, because whoever was on the ground back in the West was in a way making the decision who was going to come. But I'd say then, on the other hand, I'd say it was hard enough for people to uproot at that time. So I'm not sure that there was an avalanche of people back in Connemara or back in the Hillan making a decision to move to Rathearn, you know, but definitely an element of politics back in 1935.
The complaint in the Dáil is that there were other political allegiances as well, Fianna Gael, Cumann na Gael, and so that it was wrong that only Fianna Fáil members should get. And we think this is part of the reason that the Land Commission records have never been opened, is that it's going to open such a can of worms and there's going to be such bad press, because it was a very fraught time.
Connacht Tribune, 20th of April, 1935. Goodbye, Connemara, new Gaelic colony. 11 families, consisting of about 80 persons, who have been born, bred and reared in the heart of the Gaeltacht, said goodbye to their native Connemara in the early hours of Friday morning. They left for Rathcarn, near Athboy, County Meath, where under the government scheme designed to relieve poverty-stricken areas and to establish a Gaeltacht colony in the Midlands, they will be provided with new homes. There was no obligation on them to go, but the broadlands of Meath must have appeared to them like a little bit of heaven after a lifetime spent...
The house was there. There may have had an outbuilding. They would have had equipment, quite a bit of equipment, and then they would have shared a harrow with their neighbour. So there was an awful lot done. These were, in a sense, model farms, beautifully set up, and you can still see them, of course, when you go through the colony, these nice little houses. There was one stone-built house, but the rest of them were not as beautifully done as that, and so they were all rendered. The agricultural advisor, he came regularly, and he was probably about the only person in the whole scheme, in the whole area, that spoke Irish. They went to a lot of trouble to get an Irish speaker. But up before then, and after then, they didn't really have Irish speakers who were advising the Irish speakers, and so it was rather difficult.
Only for the Department of Agriculture, or if there was such a thing in 1935, and Pádraig Gleeson in particular, the guy that they had, he was on hand here to show them how to till the land and how to plant the seeds and grow corn and potatoes and all these things. You know, they were able to grow potatoes, but the type of growing that they did in soil, you know, full of rocks and everything, and the type of like you're talking about horses here and you're talking about plough and all that, they certainly wouldn't have seen anything like that.
The farming practices were quite different. I mean, you have fairly rich soil in Meath and nothing at all very good in the west of Ireland. As they say in Canada, they grow rocks. So they had to learn a new method of farming, and the agricultural advisor was there to help them. And they had a couple of mistakes when they first arrived. They did have a crop failure, but they learnt, and some of their neighbours in the area were helpful, the local farmers.
They took to it, you know, they were hard-working people, you know, and they all came from nearly the same part of Connemara, an area called the Islands, around Letterhamullen, Maumeen, Lettermore and all that area, right into Carrow. And then obviously throw in a few families from Rosmuck who would have the same background, same strong Gaelgor background and all that, and hard working people. Like, I mean, these knew what work was, you know, so that stood to them.
So there was quite a bit of initial support, but once everything settled down and people then had to pay annuities. Each year they had to pay so much, and this was designated, I think it was around £8 a year. They were a bit taken aback by that. They thought it was only five, but it went up to eight, and so that was a bit fraught. But that's pretty much it. They didn't do very much else. There was no what you would have today, resettlement. People would be coming in and maybe counseling people. They just thought that we should be so lucky, so thankful to have got this lovely place. Then that was all they really needed.
What many had not anticipated was the pain of leaving their home for an unknown, far-off destination.
Connacht Tribune, 20th of April, 1935. Mixed feelings of new planters, poignant farewell scenes. We left Lettermore and proceeded to Gorumna Island, from which two families were being taken. The Boreen leading up to the homesteads was inaccessible for a car, so we parked it, and leaving Mr. Culloden to do the best he could with the lorries, I walked on up the Boreen. As I turned a bend in the Boreen and came within sight of the hovels, they were little more, I heard a wailing cry which pierced my heart. It was the old women keening, and their wailing, rising from a crooning diminuendo to a piercing crescendo, sent a shiver down my spine. As I came closer to the cottages, the villagers clustered at the doors of their homes as if loath to leave. They had heard the lorries approaching, and they knew the time of parting was nigh.
I suppose it was very difficult for a lot of people leaving their communities in the west of Ireland. The people that came to Rathcarron were all from the same area. Some of them may have known each other, but they weren't a community. It took quite a bit of getting used to, and the social structures would have changed, and the expectations with assistance to each other, where you had your families who would naturally help you. You had to then make relationships with your neighbours so that your neighbours would help you. And so it must have been a very difficult time coming to a place without meaning, leaving a place full of history and connections, or that field, you knew the name of that field because it had a history, whereas you come to Meath to a new place and there's no history. So you had to develop that. And so that must have been uncomfortable for people, and particularly the distances they had to travel. To us is nothing. But some of them may never have gone back to the west of Ireland. For the elderly, and there were a lot of elderly people who came with this one. This was unusual. They brought entire families with them when they came. So some of those people knew they would never get back to the west of Ireland. It must have been a very uncomfortable time.
Like when they left in 1935, you know, New Zealand is closer to us today, you know, or Australia, you know, but the chances are if somebody goes there, they will come back. But in 1935, anybody leaving Connemara, the chances were that they would not come back, you know. And there is a story going that back in Trawan, Nicholas O'Curran, for example, the reporters were there and he brought them out and he showed them Trawan. And back there, obviously, you can see as far as the eye can. And he told them, you know, he was 82 years of age, and he said to them, you know, that I will never see this again. As things turned out, he didn't see it again because, unfortunately, the poor man died within 2 years. And I would say that he died of a broken heart.
Yes, I think that's repeated in everything you read about why people, the open skies, and don't forget, too, the sea allowed them another income, gathering of seaweed for sale, and then I suppose to some degree some fishing. Also, they used seaweed as a fertilizer in the beds they had there. So the whole connection socially to place in terms of the sea was also missing. There was nowhere to go, you know. There's no idea on how the changing of the seasons to the storms that would come in. That whole climate too is different. I think that the sea, I've spoken to people recently, you know, who live by the seaside, and they find it very quiet and still living in the Midlands. And one family certainly went back. They couldn't take it, and off they went. And when I was doing later on in the 1960s with these group migrations, I interviewed some people for a project I was doing then, and she still missed it. She still missed the sea. It's the whole feel of the sea, I think.
The chances were that they were never going to come back. You know, that they were never going to see it again, not alone come back. And then to leave their friends, to leave their neighbours, to leave their community, and to face up to a new challenge, like, okay, the first day, you know, they were looking out on green fields and saying, this is great, you know, but then they have to make a living. They have to grow the turnips, the potatoes, they have to grow the carrots. And we're talking about large families, you know. No matter where you are, your roots are, you know, and their roots were taken away, dug up, taken away entirely. So a lot of the generation, of course, it was a great challenge and it was great for them, but the sadness for them too. You know, if things were great back in Connemara, they would never have come, you know, but they were looking for a new beginning for their own children, you know, and the future.
You're listening to The Making of a Gaeltacht on Newstalk 106 to 108.
We're now just within the boundary of the Gaeltacht. And the road that we're on, or going into now, is this is the West Kerry Road. It's Bohortáilteann, but this area, they came from west of Dingle. So, Moriarty's, Garvey's.
Cahill is driving me the short distance from Rockharn to the adjoining village of Ballygib, part of the Meath Gaeltacht that was established later and made up of residents from other Gaeltacht regions aside from Connemara.
Kerry's loss, Ireland's gain. 14 more Gaeltacht families settle in Meath. With mingled feelings of joy and sorrow, 9 families from the West Kerry Gaeltacht arrived at the Gaelic colony at Gibbstown, County Meath, last evening. Small fisher farmers who had striven by night and day to wrest an existence from the barren lands of Kerry in the depths of the Atlantic Ocean gazed wonderingly at the long stretches of fertile fields of the Gibbstown estate, their new home. They were unable to control their feelings of delight when they entered the roomy dwellings where great turf fires flamed on wide hearths and government-supplied foodstuffs stood ready.
We're visiting Unshin O'Garvey at his home in Ballygib. Unshin is now in his 90s, and like many people in the Meath Gaeltacht, Irish is his first language.
Henry.
Well, my family came from Lateef Moor in Corcoraine, originally. My father was a blow-in there. He was in the Royal Navy in those days, in 1921, War of Independence and Civil Wars and things like that. There was no great love lost or great welcome for a retired Irishman who served in England during the war. Dad and my brother Dennis, who was 6 years older than I was, decided they'd come up to meet. My mother decided she'd stay at home. So Dad and Dennis arrived here in 1937.
Yeah, the other one is very good too, if you could find it, the one about Daddy coming on the bus.
Unshin's neighbours Eileen and Maura Sheehy have a wealth of old news articles about the establishment of the Gaeltacht at Gibbstown.
That's my grandfather, our grandfather.
Oh, right.
And my cousin. And that was from Times Pictorial. And he was telling a story you know, about the old days, and my cousin James was listening to him.
My father left Dunquin, and my mother was from Clogher, but near Ballyferriter, and they came up on a bus to have a look at the area, and he was the only English speaker because he had been in America for about 10 years, because a lot of the other just spoke Irish only. And they looked at the land, and about 20 families decided to come up. And they came up in March. And when the next morning when they woke up, the place was covered in snow. And because you don't get any snow, or very rarely get snow in Kerry, so, and it was quite cold, very cold. And then there were 20 houses, and most, they all knew one another, more or less. And that was just the beginning of it.
Yeah, that's it, Maura.
Oh, yeah.
That's that one.
Yeah.
Kerry Gaeltacht residence, here's one. 1939. Oh, my God, it's so hard to read.
Yeah.
One article in particular stands out as it describes Maura and Eileen's parents in their new life in Meath.
Having finished with our inspection, we set off to take tea in one of the Gaeltacht houses. Some of the party decided to go to a Donegal one, but we choose a Kerry household. As we crossed the threshold, we were welcomed by the Banatee, a smiling bride of 2 months' standing. The cottage is large and airy.
In fact, more house than cottage and spotlessly clean. The outside is white, and the interior distempered a golden fawn. A kettle hung over a turf fire. The sight of 4 griddle cakes whetted our appetite. But the marvel of all was to see sausages and eggs frying in a pan on a little heap of turf ash scooped out from the fire. The table was perfectly laid. The bride and bridegroom boasted of a wireless set, and we sat down funnily enough to the tune of South of the Border, Down Mexico Way. The Faratee came in then, a very tall, graceful, rather Spanish-looking young man with twinkling, humorous eyes and a wonderful flow of melodious Irish. He was obviously pleased at the genuine compliments paid to his little wife's cooking. And she had her hands full because a young teacher and 4 schoolboys from Dublin in his charge were being put up for the week. May God bless that young couple starting out on their new life in their small house.
As with the Connemara migrants, the Kerry migrants felt a similar wrench when leaving their homes.
I mean, nowadays, you know what the rest of the world lives like. You can look at documentaries or anything. That time, they were using their imagination, maybe in descriptions and letters and stuff, what County Meath was like at the time for them. And it was very far away for them. I mean, they hadn't left. Probably the nearest place they went to was Dingle or Tralee, if they had to go to hospital or something, although there was a hospital in Dingle at the time. Or maybe some of them were never more than 10 miles away from their house. Not like nowadays, you hop on a plane and go to Australia or go to New Zealand or go to America. I mean, you must remember what it was like in the 1937.
Oh, they missed the sea, definitely, and all the neighbours missed the sea and the mountains. Some of them couldn't stick the place at all. At least 4 of our neighbours here who came from Kerry returned within 12 months. 4 families went back and reclaimed, and they had that option. It was part of the agreement that within 7 years, if they didn't like me, that they could return and reclaim what they left behind.
Grandfather used to talk about the fishing because they were very involved. You know, they had the little knivogues and go out fishing for whatever they were fishing for, and they missed that, and they missed the mountains and the scenery. Yeah. And they were used to lots of visitors as well. The visitors were beginning to come that time. That was probably in the 20s, 30s. People learning Irish, maybe people wanted to see a way of life that was in the Blasket Islands and wanted to have experienced the way of life that was disappearing at the time.
My mother used to miss very much the scenery, the sea and the mountains, you know, this flat land. She couldn't see much beauty in it, whereas my father didn't miss it because he said, you can't live on scenery.
The migrants to Gibbstown were drawn from not only the Kerry Gaeltacht, but also from Donegal and Mayo. This decision to bring a number of people from different Gaeltacht regions would cause unexpected difficulties. Although they all spoke Irish, it wasn't necessarily the same Irish, and many found the different dialects difficult to understand.
That came as an awful shock to them. They thought everybody spoke Irish like as they did themselves. In those days, of course, there was no radio on the Gaeltacht there or anything like that to introduce them to all these different dialects that we have.
It was kind of difficult to understand the Irish, in Donegal Irish in particular. We have great fun, you know, trying to figure out what there is, our Donegal friends, what they're saying, but you get used to it.
They even use different words. I never realised so much, but this lady we were talking about, one day we were outside, and the next thing she said something about Féach na Clouthí. And I kind of looked, what is she talking about? And she used the word Clouthí for clouds,
yeah.
Whereas we would use the word Scammon.
Yeah.
You know, so even something like that, yeah. You know, you never think there was such a difference.
Yeah. We'd always speak Irish to one another and do our best to speak it to our neighbours from Mayo and Donegal. But we never gelled as a Gaeltacht, you know. I speak to my neighbours, the Sheehys, the O'Neills, the Bolands, the Moriartys, you know. But when I meet Mayo men and Donegal men, I might speak whatever Irish to them. They wouldn't speak it to me. They'll turn to English straight away. They don't like my Irish properly. You understand one another better in English, I'm sorry to say, than in Irish.
The Meath Gaeltacht is now a long-established and welcome addition to the county, but I wonder what the response was initially to the Gaeltacht migrants.
Well, the response by the migrants to the migrants coming by the colony was not too bad. Everybody said hello, and it was very welcoming. The first group of migrants that came had a big ceremony, big party. People from all around the area came as well. There were actually classes in Irish held in Athboy. Some of the politicians were a bit irate because so much had been happening before the actual Gaeltacht migration. One of the politicians said that the Irish, the people of Meath, are being scrooged out by the coming of the migrants. There was some negative opinion. Some of the houses were dabbed with slogans. These houses are for Meath people, not migrants.
Connacht Tribune, Friday, October 25th, 1935. Shots in Gaeltacht Colony. Two new unoccupied houses in the Gaeltacht Colony, Rathcarn, Athboy, County Meath, were fired into last night, and a third new and occupied house was broken into and paint and brushes were taken from it. There are several bullet marks on the door of one of the houses, and inscriptions were painted on two doors. The first inscription read, "No more migrants wanted here." And on a second door, there was the inscription, "This land is not for Connemara people, it is for the..."
The peculiar history of the Meath Gaeltacht is intertwined with the vision of the Irish Free State, of creating an Irish Ireland. It was established not only with the aim of easing congestion on the poor land of the Gaeltacht areas, but also in the hope of preserving and promoting the Irish language.
Now, what we have to remember, of course, is that the migration was not just happening in groups or colonies. They were happening as individual families across the west of Ireland and then slowly beginning to move into the mid and eastern counties. There was a lot of migration going on. It was only this big change with where Irish-speaking migrants were chosen specifically to bring the whole ethos of the Irish language into the new recognition that people's identity was fixed with the Irish language. I mean, this is the whole thing with the Gaelic League that had started back in the late 19th century, and that slowly it became a statement of your national identity. It was to be able to speak Irish. And so with Eamon de Valera very much wanted the identity of people to be fixed with the Irish language and to be rural. so that the Gaelic colonies were a different process. Because the people in the east of Ireland had been learning Irish as part of the kind of their nationalist ideals, once the Gaelic colony came, they really thought that this was going to be a perfect place for them to develop their Irish language. But of course, the Irish they were learning in the cities in the east was not quite the same as what was in the colony. And so they found they couldn't understand the Galway Irish. But still they came, I suppose at weekends. It would come down, and there's a report in the newspaper of them peering through windows as if they were anthropological specimens they could examine. So it was a bit tricky. As I said, the newspaper report asked them not to go so much down to. So that's really just a very brief period in there where they were inundated with curiosity seekers to practice their Irish.
Meath Chronicle, 18th of May, 1935. Interest in the Gaelic colony continues unabated, and visitors make it a mecca on Sundays, not only from Meath, but to judge from the registration numbers of cars from far distant places. Dublin in particular sends a large quota of sightseers. On Sunday, an interesting group...
Some of the work that I've done that show in the newspapers, the government is saying, please don't descend on Rathcarran in quite such numbers, because after all, these people's homes, they're not to be like specimens. But there was very little negativity.
Some generations later, the residents of the Meath Gaeltacht, Rathcarran in particular, recognise how important their Connemara heritage is to their own identity.
I think it's important for us to keep that Cangal, or to keep that connection with Connemara, because if we let that die, you know, that's our only outlet in a way, because if you take it, you know, being a small little Gaeltacht area, there's a lot of pressure on the Irish language. So we have to, I suppose, work together to keep the Irish language alive, but we also have to keep the connection with our roots and with our culture. And we're doing that, and Radio na Gaeltacht and Television na Gaeltacht, they're a big help. But also, unless people get up and drive and go back to Connemara, go back to where their ancestors came from and all this, they have to do that. And I'm trying to instill that into my own children, you know, at the time, and hopefully that they will do it with their own children.
If you're looking at the songs and poetry here, the first song that was written about Rathcarran that I know of is Cundan na Mí by Seosamh O'Donoghue, and he would have been one of the great poets from Connemara, and he basically had a look. Basically, the theme of that one, which I think is really, really sad, is that he's looking at all these people who have packed up all their stuff, passing his door, walking or on a bus to County Meath. Ermadzin zehina, she hula me an quina, iscar chrua ag dini ag ta chugam sa tli. Ag shanir is ag shan vna ag fagal na gaeltachta, le dera a chud lehinta a chahav ag undan na mi. So even that concept that these men and women that were probably quite old at that point were leaving Connemara, probably would not return, and that they were going to County Meath. You know, this movement of people passing his door, and that it really just got him in the heart.
Cathal Seoighe's daughter Siobhan has done extensive research on the songs and poetry of Rathcarran in the Meath Gaeltacht, compiling a small but crucial snapshot of the cultural history of her community.
Yeah, there's a poem by my granddad. So I'm sitting with my little headphones on, listening to my granddad say a poem that he'd written in commemoration for the 1985, the 50 years, and I'm listening to his voice for the first time probably in, I don't know, 10, 20 years. And it was amazing, and it was great. And you not only that, but it kind of struck me as well how much of a Connemara man he was and how much of a Connemara he had. And also the message of the poem that he wrote is that, you know, he's talking about community and he's talking about how amazing it is that we survive, but also not to forget that part of what makes us a community and what makes us great is that we have Irish. So that was pretty sweet, I have to say. It was lovely.
Although established in the 1930s, it wasn't until 1967 that the Míth Gaeltacht, made up of the adjoining villages of Rockarn and Ballyhib, was given official Gaeltacht status after a concerted effort by the community. So how now do we judge its success?
I think it is a huge success. It's humming. Everybody you mention, you know, I was when I was working on this project, I would say, oh, I'm looking, oh, we know the Gaeltacht there. My family, my friend, I went, everybody knows Rathcairn, and they all have been for various reasons to the colony. And also the whole vibrancy of the community in my little experience of visiting and hearing about what's going on, I'm sure it is a wonderful success. I mean, there's a secondary school quite near, and to me that is the thing that designates a successful community. If you have a secondary school close by that you can feed your children into, because you've got children to feed into it, you know. So I feel it's a huge success. And it, again, as I said, it's down to the people who stepped into the roles of the leader of the colony, who are credited with all of that. You can easily lose your way if no one is, you know, saying is a cheerleader for what you're doing. I think you can, things can fade. You need a leader.
For the Free State government, the creation of the Míth Gaeltacht was a social experiment that would not be repeated. It exists today as the smallest and youngest Gaeltacht in Ireland, and its unique history, the life-changing journey that the Gaeltacht migrants undertook, has never been forgotten.
They would be heroes. All those people would be heroes in my eyes.
Rachairn the Grainne nach Bradas an Oitu, ta Situ Ordon in Lor Bantan Ami, Green is Galach, ex Galagach Lawn, ni Balin is Olia, the Fallen's Tear.
Hookani Rachairn your Magin Bradagrena, the Swalam of the Fierce and Catin Polonoid. And half of the all in the summer got saved it. A portion of your air was the worst in that need. Oh, how one of the way to be saved that I see. Oh, yes, he taught him as a son of the bone. He had it on one to play the
The Making of a Gaeltacht was produced by Judy Meg Nicanaja. Additional sound editing by Fergal Sachs and voice actor was Peter Kavanagh. The programme was supported by a grant from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland as part of the Sound and Vision Scheme.